So we discussed last time that we can split essentially the balance law problem into this in this operator split fashion, in which we take the split approach. First, we evolve the exact conservation law, and then we time integrate the source terms. And so, depending on the source terms, and this is what we finished with last time. Depending on the source terms, the source terms will give rise to a system of ODE equations that we need to integrate. And so depending on the exact physics that represents, that these source terms represent, we might have stiff ODEs, for example. So there might be all sorts of complications. And that essentially defines what kind of numerical scheme we need to use to evolve those or to sort of do this time integration. So we can have either explicit update schemes, or we can have implicit schemes depending on the stiffness and so the properties of these source terms. We can also have a combination of the two, an implicit explicit method, so so-called IMEX method. So maybe some of you have heard of this as well. There could be also this would be typically applied to source terms where we have, a sum of different source terms, some of which might be integrable with an explicit scheme, some of which need to be treated with an implicit scheme because they give rise to a stiff source term. And so we can also have combinations of those. In any case, depending on the source terms, we have to choose some evolution scheme. And this raises the question of how to actually choose the time stepping for the overall operator split method. And so this is just something I wanted to remark here. So again, we have first our PDE to evolve. And we can do this with a Godunov type scheme, in which case, you remember that we have the CFL-like condition that essentially provides a constraint on the time step, namely that neighboring Riemann problems and solutions from neighboring Riemann problems should not interfere within a given time step delta t. So we'll have some constraint on the time step, which I'll call delta ta for now for advection, for sort of the advection part of the problem. And then we need to integrate the source terms. And so as mentioned last time, we can have sort of nice source terms in the sense that they don't provide any stiffness. We may be able to use high order explicit methods. And then a stability analysis of this ODE system will then provide us with some constraints on the time step delta TS for source that we can afford for this particular problem. They might also be stiff, as remarked last time, and we might have to use implicit methods, and they often or essentially don't come with a restriction on the time step, at least not in terms of stability, at least not what sort of stability is concerned for. So in this case, we can in principle just choose this to be our fluid evolution time step. But if we're in the other case where we can use explicit methods, and this is fairly often the case, then usually if the ODE system allows for a greater time step, then we would just take the time step of the Godunov scheme to be our global evolution time step. And we would just evolve both subproblems with the same delta t, which makes everything Very simple. Okay, and then the other case is obviously when delta TS is smaller than delta TA, in which case we have to advance the ODE system for multiple time steps before we can catch up with the hydro, or say with the advection problem. So we would then do something like delta TL equals delta TA over L. And then advance PDE with delta TA. Okay, and this just triggers another remark. If we have to do multiple time steps with the ODE system, then we have to be careful that we don't use multi-step methods, because that would interfere with the evolution of the conservation law, so with the advection problem. So this is just one final remark on this. This is one reason why you will not find multi-step methods in such hydro codes. And so the reason is, as I mentioned, so in multi-step methods, just to remind everyone, is essentially, you know, where you use not just the previous time step, but also sort of more than one of the previous time steps. So you have multiple time levels involved in a given update. And here the problem is that a given time level, data at a certain time, Tn, is actually produced by this intermediate, actually represents an intermediate step of the overall balance law scheme that is produced by advecting the conservation law, so by solving just the conservation law. And so we don't have access to sort of previous time steps. So Un, and so we call this intermediate step U bar N. And so those are not actually produced by this ODE, but by a different problem, namely by evolving the conservation law. So we cannot just go one time level back to UN minus one. N minus one bar was obtained from U n minus one by use of a different equation. Namely the conservation law. So this is why you'll always find use of so-called one-step methods and most well-known families here is the Runge-Kutta methods. And here the trick is, in order to get higher accuracy, sort of beyond Euler, so beyond sort of first order accuracy, is to essentially invent intermediate steps where you try to sample your source function at intermediate steps and then combine these estimates of intermediate steps in a way to sort of minimize your error function, so to get higher order accuracy. So as I mentioned, explicit Romeo-Cotta methods are sort of a very typical choice here. So most often used, as we know, is Romeo-Cotta 4. So there's actually, if you're interested in more details on Runge-Kutta methods, there's actually a nice presentation in the Vex book on finite differences that I can recommend. And so that's chapter 5.7. So I don't want to go into details here because that completely sidetrack us. But I can highly recommend this if you're if you want to read up a little bit on integration of ODE systems. And there's also nice discussions about all the stability issues and things like that. Okay, and with this, I actually wanted to sort of end this part on operator split methods here. Are there any final questions on this? Okay. If not, then let's do something else for a change, and let's hear from you on some of the past and current problems, and look at some of the issues from a more practical implementation point of view. I would probably suggest we start with the Godunov, with the Riemann solver first, maybe, just to make sure that we definitely cover this. And so maybe if Michael is ready and ready to start. So the idea would be Michael walks us a little bit through the code and how the Riemann solver works. And then we'll hear from a few others like Connor and Boris who will show a few more plots. And maybe Tim, if he's ready, can sort of then also present his bonus question on the proof on the entropy condition, and then we'll go a little bit back in time and hear from Boris and Guillaume on the previous coding problems. Does that sound okay?
Yep.
Okay, perfect. Let me stop sharing for now.
Okay. So the way that I did it is I kind of tried to make this fine solution function just pretty much as close to how you do the Riemann problem, the exact Riemann problem in general. So the first step is you find P, so U and P in the star region are both the same. So you find P in the star region using Newton's method. Once you know P, you can take that solution plug it back into those functions that Daniel showed earlier in lecture to get U. And then once you know P and U in the star region, you can find rho. So the way that rho works is if it's a shock, you get one thing. If it's a rarefaction, you get another. So this left one determines by looking at whether P is bigger in the like leftmost region or in the left star region. And that determines whether it's a left shock or left rarefaction. And then based on that, you find the rho star left. And then you do the same thing for rho star right. And then once you have PU, rho star left, rho star right, you can essentially go through, look at each point X for a given T, and find what the value of each of the PU or density, pressure, and velocity are. And so I don't think it's really necessary to go over the Newton's method. So I'll just cut to how we find P, U, U.
Tiny problem.
Pardon?
Sorry. Sorry to interrupt. Although there was like a tiny problem there in the Newton's method that the pressure could get negative, and so some of you were noticing that, and a tiny fix had to be implemented to make sure that the pressure always stays positive and the Newton method actually converges to a physical solution. But everyone got that. So, right.
So why did you tell us to start with a guess that's particularly high? Would it not make sense to start with a low guess and then it'll always go upwards kind of? Because if you start high, then it'll overshoot and give you negative.
Right. Yeah, you're right. So, and I think it was specifically for the second problem or so where it did overshoot quite a bit. And so, yeah, that might happen. So the reason why I gave you that initial guess was because it's the most simple to calculate. So there's other, and some of you noticed that there's other, possible choices one can make as an initial guess. Some of which would actually provide the exact solution in some cases. So in practice, then one would use sort of a more elaborate set of initial guesses for Newton's method. But this one also works. One just needs to make sure that when it overshoots, you cut it up and don't go to negative pressure values. But since the function, and this is something we showed in the lectures as well, discussed, it's actually usually fairly well behaved, so it's fairly smooth function, that Newton's method should actually converge regardless, as long as you prevent it from going negative and overshooting too much.
So I'm not sure how everyone else handled finding the values of P, U, and rho as a function of X. Essentially, what I did is I treated the rarefaction and shock identically. And so when you have a shock, you kind of have a head and tail, but they're both the same speed. And so if you check, so you calculate the head and tail speed, whether you're in a rarefaction or shock. And so you see that for the shock case, I just set both the speeds to be the same. And then I go through looking essentially which region I'm in. So if I'm lower than the left tail speed, I just get the left quantities. If I'm inside the left rarefaction, I calculate the quantities accordingly. But if you notice that from these expressions, if the left tail and left head speed are the same, which is what I said they were for the shock, you can never be in this region. And so you don't need to actually treat the rarefaction differently from the shock. And so, yeah, you do the same thing for pretty much every other region. The right discontinuity works in exactly the same fashion. So, yeah, once you have that, you're pretty much set for any given X and T.
Yes, great. Thanks a lot. Do you also have your final plots here to illustrate the solution, or other? If not, we can also just move on to Connor or someone else.
I don't.
Okay.
I could pull them up in a separate document, but
yeah, that's fine. No worries. We can move on. So maybe Connor, if you're ready.
Sure.
Show us your solution. So I noticed you had this nice Mathematica notebook where you can actually look at this in a sort of
time-dependent
way.
Mathematica is well suited for some stuff like this. First of all, just because it's really nice that I can just sort of define like literal functions that look basically identical to the way they would in like Toro's book, for example. So I can essentially copy them verbatim and not worry about them being lost in translation. So like I can you know, write things in actual piecewise form, which is pretty useful, I think. But the other really cool thing I can do is, you know, once you've done all of, you know, the definitions and stuff that you might find in the book and different problems, you know, defining your fan functions and all this different stuff, you write out the solution exactly how they would look in piecewise form. Normally we think about we plot these things in like X and T space, but you can, you know, use your time dimension in a manipulate object to actually see how this thing might change in time. So, for example, for the first problem where we have the sort of shock and refraction wave, you can sort of play. Actually, I think this is the second one. Yeah, I think this is the second one, but why it's not looking how I expect. I might try running this again. Something might be weird would have happened. I spent some time actually getting this to look how I expected, but here we go.
Yeah, there we go. Now it seems correct. Yeah.
Yeah, so something got monkey in there. So yeah, you can actually play this and see what happens. And so you can sort of watch the two sort of shock fronts on the edge sort of move on to the right, and then your sort of rarefaction wave. Actually, I'm not sure if you can see my cursor.
We can. Yep, that looks good.
Awesome. So you can just sort of watch these things play out, which is I think super instructive, just to see like. You know, what's the actual solution that we're sort of aiming for? I don't know, like one of the things that I sort of had an aha moment was we talk about the sort of rarefaction fan solution. Never really understood what we really meant by that, but it's you know, just sort of like a function that connects two of the discontinuous parts of this. So it's nice to see that.
Then, right, and this is why these numerical experiments are great, because it provides you a completely different angle, essentially at the material, right, and to understand things from the sort of practical point of view, and that's can provide these kind of aha moments. I'm glad you had one.
yeah, for sure. And you can play with this for all the different primitive variables, so like the velocity, for example. It's kind of interesting to see, you know, here's your initial condition, nothing's moving, but, you know, the shockwave front sort of forms and you have sort of a variable velocity on the rarefaction end, but then you have a nice shock front on the shock end. You can play around with it. The pressure only has like one sort of shock, I guess. And then the same sort of rarefaction type format in the other one.
Right. So you can nicely see, and I think Boris is going to show this to us. So he has some plots on the Riemann invariance. So the two plots here you just showed, one can nicely see how the pressure and the velocity are actually k Riemann invariants, so two Riemann invariants in this case, across the contact discontinuity. So they just stay constant in the star region. So as you mentioned, they only vary across the rarefaction wave and the shock.
Oh, nice.
And so if you compare this to the above, so for the density, the first plot you showed, so there you can see, so the density here has a jump right across the contact discontinuity in the middle, right? Exactly there, yeah. Which indicates that it's not a two Riemann invariant, right? Perfect, okay.
Awesome. And nice. Then I wasn't sure if this was going to work when I first was coding this, but I can actually take the piecewise functions and just literally divide them and had no problem. And then you can, might have to run this again.
Yeah. Yes.
And then you can watch what happens to the internal energy. It sort of has a weird form at the beginning as the shocks are forming, but then sort of moves along.
Mm-hmm. And also here we see it's not conserved across the contact discontinuity.
Yeah. And then, yeah, for the second problem, found I have to run all this again to actually get this to work. And then I sort of touched on this point that you talked about before, where I tried running it at the normal p guess, and of course the first value it returns is negative. So in actual Toro's book, he gives a following expression for a different guess in the case that you have two rarefaction waves. And which is nice is I can just sort of write out this definition that they put in the book out literally. And it turns out this is the exact expression for the P guess. So if you run this same thing, trying to do the iterative process, you only have to do it once because it's already exact. So that's a cool thing I got out of Toro's book. And then if I run the rest of this,
Dan, do you mind if I ask a question?
Sure.
Go ahead.
So P is uniquely determined from the quantities on the left and quantities on the right. Mm-hmm. The P star is determined from those in every single case.
Right.
And so is there some general check just based purely on the quantities on the left and right, whether you're in a rarefaction, like whether it's a left rarefaction shock, or do you have to compute P and then check based on that?
Oh, so you mean whether there's a way to tell the nature of the solution independent of P?
Yeah, without first finding P.
Yeah, unfortunately not. At least not to my knowledge. So your best chances are to find P and then see, you know, how it compares to the pressure on the left and the right to see what kind of wave you have. So that's unfortunately the only way to tell, the only practical way to tell the nature of the solution.
I have like a sort of suspicion that because all of these, you know, all these problems are highly nonlinear, that you might get some like chaotic behavior. Like if you imagine trying to sort of separate the like the six dimensional space of all the initial conditions, right? The left and the right ones for the, you know, the three different primitive variables, and I'd try imagine like put like subregions of that space that are to one solution or one to the other. I suspect that because it's nonlinear, though, you might get like weird chaotic behavior where if you change the initial conditions just a tiny little bit, then you're going to, you know, jump into a different region. There's not going to be like a very simple, I don't know, it's just like my suspicion.
Right. So there's some truth to this. You're right. So just changing, you know, so we were always talking. So when we were introducing and discussing the general Riemann problem, right, we were always, so as Connor mentioned, right, so we were discussing in state space. And it's true that if you just change two states, so say we fix one, right? So we always usually fix sort of the left state or so, and then we just vary the right state. And so the nature of the solution can actually change quite dramatically, even if we just change the right, this sort of right value a little bit. And that has to do with how these Rankine, Ugonio, Loci, and rarefaction wave, so these integral curves behave. And so by changing it slightly, just a little bit, then the nature of the wave can become different. So from like having a rarefaction wave, you can move to a shock wave or, you know, something like that.
Has anyone ever tried to produce a color map of those things to see?
Yes. Good point, Eric. So Boris will show us a color map of this, actually. Oh, cool. But maybe we should just let Connor maybe finish second case.
So that's next little bit is just, you know, defining the second problem solutions, and then we can play around with them. So in this one, you get, I'm going to try running this again. I'm getting a weird thing in the middle.
Yeah.
Let me see if I missed some definition here.
No, it looks good.
Okay, here we go. Yeah, I have everything split into different modules just to be instructive for the actual assignment. It probably could have been more efficiently spaced, but. So yeah, so here's you know the two rarefaction wave solution. So we're just moving, it almost looks practically parabolic, or pretty close at least, in the density at least. And then as you play around with the velocity, you have, you know, one part of the wave that's moving to the left and you have one part of the wave that's moving to the right. And then, so for the pressure, it looks basically the same except for sort of magnitude as the density. And then you can play with the internal energy again. In this case, it looks pretty similar to the other ones as well.
Right.
That's basically it for, you know, playing with the time dependence.
Very nice. Thank you.
Yeah, that's Connor, there's one more parameter I think it'd be fun to play with, the gamma.
Mm-hmm.
Gamma, the adiabatic constant?
Yeah.
Yeah, you could probably do that, but I have it set up just so that like it's a set value. But that would be fun to play with, actually. I'd have to redefine a lot of these functions as functions of gamma in order to change it, but yeah, that would be interesting. Actually, there's a lot of the constants and stuff that you would also have to keep as functions of gamma. So yeah, you would have to be very careful.
Okay, great. Thanks. And so by the way, and so this is something that will also become nicely obvious in Boris' color plots. So this second problem actually kind of creates something like a vacuum state in the middle. So it's really rarefying the solution a lot. And so this is why the second problem is often used as like a test on how a Godunov scheme, for example, a given Godunov scheme can handle low density regions like the atmosphere of a star or, you know, things like that. because as we mentioned, you know, earlier, some Riemann solvers have actually problems with these low density regions. They can lead to unphysical values. And so this is usually a nice test case.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you want to make a comment about something we were talking about earlier about this, in the six dimensional space of all possible things, it's probably maybe five because you have some symmetry, but it actually would be nice to see in this whole space which regions correspond to a double rarefaction, double shock or shock and rarefaction, and see if there's something significant about the edges between them.
Right. Yeah.
There
so the
function of initial conditions that corresponds to where this transition takes place.
Right. Right. So this is what we discussed. Right. So these are so what you would look at are these integral curves, and you would look at these shock sets. So every eigenvalue and every pair of eigenvalue and eigenvector of the Jacobian of our conservation law, of our set of conservation laws, gives rise to an integral curve and a shock set. In some cases, when they are linearly degenerate and they are identical, and so this is what gives rise to a contact discontinuity. In the other cases, we have either a rarefaction wave or a shock. And if you connect two points in the state space that lie on one of these special curves, right, then you get one of these special solutions. And if you only move a tiny bit away from such a curve, then you change the nature of the solution into this general threefold nature, where you know you would in general have a contact discontinuity, a rarefaction wave, and a shock wave. And so it is essentially these special curves that define different regions in the state space, and they separate essentially those regions where you have either like a two shock solution or a rarefaction and a shock and so on. These four possibilities, for example, for the Euler equations that we were discussing, those are essentially separated by these special lines, and so that's sort of roughly the geometry of the state space. Okay, but it's more difficult to visualize here for the Euler equations because we're already in 3D. You can so there's simpler versions. So for example, if you look at the sort of the shallow water equations, which is a set of two equations, or other systems with sort of two equations, then one can actually nicely visualize these different regions in state space where you have different types of solutions, and they are just sort of bounded or separated by these special curves. Okay. Anything else on this? Boris, are you ready?
Yeah.
Regarding your plots, perfect.
Can you guys see my screen?
Yes, we can.
All right. So yeah, it's assignment five. Like everyone else, bunch of equations from the book. I had a bunch of validation tests that I want to go through. Let's see, just call it right. Just remind myself. So the first one is I wanted to check, in my head I was going through and I was like, I gotta have made some bugs. So what is necessary to be checked for this to work? One is it has to match the underlying condition, that is the underlying equation. So my solution has to satisfy the equation. My solution has to satisfy the entropy condition. And then just sort of a fun check that we proved at some point that here are the K-Riemann invariants. Those should be constant across certain types of discontinuities. And I forgot what the name, RH jump conditions, whether they are satisfied across the shocks. So the way I calculate these is I write down my equations. When I do the Riemann problem, I return the solutions as a function of the speed, since all the solutions are self-similar. If you take any derivative along some radial direction, it's going to be zero, but which leaves only derivatives along S that are left. So I did a little bit of algebra to figure out exactly what that is. There's a slight change of variables there. Introduces an S and a minus sign. This is just so that I can write it in one dimensional instead of having to write a two-dimensional grid and calculate numerical derivatives that way. So for the cases, so the first case, this is the shock and rarefaction wave. The first solution here is the relative error in the conservation law. So you would try to plug in the conservation law, and then you wouldn't get zero because there's some error that goes to the derivative. So I'm normalizing it by the actual the magnitude of the terms. This is actually a slight problem because most of the place where we have a solution, it's constant. So wherever we have a constant solution, it's trivially satisfied. And it's only inside the rarefaction regions that we actually have to set like a non-trivial solution of the conservation law. And that's exactly what you're seeing here. Here is the rarefaction wave solution where it's nice and, you know, small relative error with whatever step size I've chosen. And the rest is just, you know, a relative error of one because dividing by zero, it's trivially satisfied everywhere else. So that was a nice check. Next, here's the plot of the K Riemann invariance for each of the discontinuities. On the left, we have a rarefaction wave. In the middle, we have a contact discontinuity. On the right, we have a shock wave. Along the rarefaction wave, we have the one Riemann invariance, which are S and K1. K1, I think, is like U minus CR or C star. And as you can see, the entropy and K1 are constant along the rarefaction wave the whole way through, as we'd expect. Across this discontinuity in the middle, the two Riemann invariants are the velocity and the pressure, which also are constant straight through. And on the right, we have a shock. And nothing is continuous across a shock everywhere. And that's exactly what we find here, is that even though the entropy in K3 would be Riemann invariants for a fraction wave because of the shock, they aren't. And the condition has to be satisfied here would be the RH jump condition. So for the RH jump condition, what I have here is a shock speed at the right, which just has some value at 1.75, and the difference in fluxes divided by the difference in U for each of the three different quantities. And for every single one of those quantities, it matches the shock speed. Therefore, this solution satisfies those jump conditions there in all three variables. Before we get to the color plots, I want to also point out the entropy condition. This was a place in my assignment, even though it was a failure. There's an entropy condition that has to be satisfied. It's something like I have written like Ix plus psi y has to be less than or equal to zero. And I tried straight up writing this to see, is it zero everywhere? Well, at wherever you don't have discontinuities, it's zero. And across the discontinuities, there should be some increase in entropy, but decrease in the entropy that we define mathematically. And that's what I thought I was getting, but no, there's probably some numerical issue or something else that's preventing me, and I wasn't able to verify that. So,
right, but the other part is actually zero, right? So the flat part is actual literally zero, right?
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
So it's zero everywhere because, you know, we showed this in one of the earlier assignments that rho S and rho Vs are a flux and you can change one of your variables to be that. But at the discontinuities where S is not continuous, well, there'd be some extra amount of entropy and that should always push in one direction.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, I have the, now that we actually checked to make sure the solution is right, let's go and look at the solution. So here's each of the quantity, the primitive variables plotted up. Bottom is the stuff that was asked to match the book. But as a function of space, x on the x-axis, t on the y-axis, and whatever quantity in encoder bar. For those of you wondering, this is cmap equals jet in Python. And you see exactly what's happening. You have constant regions here, a fan region there, another constant region. And there's a jump in the density across this discontinuity. There's a jump in the velocity and pressures at the other shocks. And they are constant across contact discontinuity. And really what you have is just this smooth change that we talked about during the fan region. That's just a smooth change, in this case, radially. So just a 2D way of visualizing it. For the second case, same thing. We have two rarefaction waves. Inside the rarefaction waves, residual layer is small, good. We have two sets of Riemann invariants, S and K1, constant across the first fan, S and K3, constant across the second fan. You notice K1 and K3 are not the same. And U and P are constant across the discontinuity center. I guess the units don't fully match here. For the entropy, again, some bug, some failure. I wasn't able to get it. I'll have to look into what is causing this, whether it's numerical issues and so on. But I expect it to be zero everywhere and big negative spikes across the jumps, which sort of happens, but not really. But I think this is the plot that Daniel really wanted me to show off. To show what we mean by rarefaction wave is that the gas is actually rarefying. So in this case, we have a two rarefaction wave solution with positive density in each case. And what's happening is the middle region is emptying of matter while moving, and it's emptying of pressure. So what you end up having is almost zero density here, and only at the near the head speeds do you actually get the density to build up to match this flow. So gas is emptying from here, and so is internal energy. I think this is all I have to show for this. Questions?
Perfect. Very nice, Boris. Thank you. Do we have any questions? This. Yeah, so really good work, everyone. It was nice to see all the different ways that you guys sort of attacked the problem, and the little things here and there you found. Okay, very nice. So that's essentially the general Riemann problem for the Euler equations. So now let's move on. And see if Tim, did you want to present your proof to us?
Yeah, I can show my proof.
Okay, perfect. So a little bit, a few analytical things in between. I thought that it might be nice to show this to everyone, just to remind everyone of the result. We didn't do this in the lectures, and only a few that the bonus question. So I thought it was nice to share this with everyone. Okay. Please go
ahead. Can you see my screen?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, okay, cool. So, yeah, the proof that Daniel wants me to show is the one that says that if you have some conservative scheme that converges to a weak solution, and that scheme also satisfies the entropy condition, then you will converge to some entropy solution. So the proof is pretty much the same as the Lax-Vandorf one. Except that you consider the entropy condition instead of the conservative scheme equation here, right? So the same setup, you have some sequence, discrete solution that you label by L with respect to some discretization in time here, and then some discretization in space, HL, which both goes to zero as L goes to infinity. So you have smaller and smaller grids, right? And then you want this scheme to be consistent with the discrete entropy condition. So like a quick recall of what that means is that if you have some phi and psi entropy pair for some conservation law, and then you have some G that's Lipschitz continuous, and then you impose that G is consistent with your entropy flux for all vectors in Rn, then you say that your solution satisfies the discrete entropy condition if it satisfies this equation here. So this is the same equation as the conservation law, except that you consider your entropy condition here. So to show that this is true, then we're going to take a similar step as the other proof. We're going to pick some phi that's has compact support and is smooth, and we're going to multiply the equation one here by it. So you end up with some equation that looks like this. And then you want to show that both the left-hand side and the right-hand side converges to the entropy condition. Not the discrete one, but the full entropy condition, right? So, So basically to show that, we'll start with the left-hand side here, and then we're going to sum over all of space to begin. And then you can use partial sums to basically switch out space over time, not space here. Use partial sums. You can switch the difference between entropy pair versus the compact support phi. There's two phi's here, it's a bit confusing, but verify versus phi. So you sum that, and then you can use Abel's formula to switch to an integral of, like, you switch your sum into an integral, basically. And also, you can approximate this by the time derivative here. Then you sum over space afterwards. And then should be delta x here, but that's a detail. Yeah, so then if you sum over space and you can switch the sum into an integral because it's a finite sum, right? So you can just switch it, approximated by it, I mean. And now you know that your set of solution converges to U as L goes into infinity, and you know phi is continuous, so that means that you can just, this equation is going to become this one as L goes to infinity. So this is what the left-hand side is going to converge to. So now consider the right-hand side and show that converges as well. So to do that, same thing, sum, you multiply by the test function phi, and then sum over space and time. I guess one detail I forgot to mention. Here, there's a more general condition here, but I'm picking theta to be one so that the indices above are just n versus n plus one. It just makes it a bit easier.
So you're focusing on the explicit case rather than the implicit one, which would be theta equals zero, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're back here again. We want to show this convergence, so we use a similar trick with the partial sums again. And then we can switch out the difference here to be the difference in phi. Some quick notation here. Gn I plus 1/2 is this function here. It's valued at I and then the point next to it, right? So this difference we can approximate by some spatial derivative up to some order delta x. So then we get this result here, and then similar to the Lexman drift proof, we're going to let GL be this term here, and then evaluate the integral at the volume of, around at that point. And you can get that is equal to this integral plus some other order delta x. So these are two different ones. Right, and then you evaluate the sum, so you get your boundaries here. So then again, g is Lipschitz continuous. So as you take the limit of L goes to infinity, you recover g evaluated at u and u. And then g is consistent with the entropy flux. So then you can replace your g in here with the psi. So then take this and this, and this one here, put them together, and then you get the entropy condition that we have. That's pretty much it.
Could you please scroll to the first inequality in the previous page?
First inequality in the previous page. This one here?
Okay, thanks.
Tim, do you need the test field? Do you need to restrict the test field to be non-negative, or can you do it without doing that?
I think you could do it without that, right? But it vanishes in the right region if you do it. So like you'd have this extra term otherwise, no? I think I have some other.
So that's actually a great question, Guillaume. Thanks. And so I think in your solution, Guillaume, you noted that actually. And I think you're right. So here we're looking at the inequality. So the sign of the test function matters to some extent. So in principle, it would be good to restrict this to not vary sign over the compact support. So to be either only positive or only negative. So that it doesn't change the inequality globally. So that would be a nice detail that Tim, you could add to the proof if you want. Because in the other case, essentially, it doesn't matter. So for the conservative part, for the Lax-Rendorff, where we showed that it's in conservation form, we were dealing with an actual equality, and there it doesn't really matter. So the sign of the test function doesn't really matter, or so the values that the test function takes on don't really matter too much. But here, because of the inequality, they do. Mm-hmm. Great. Any other questions or comments?
I had another question. Can you have this proof for the Lax-Rendorff proof, Lax-Rendorff theorems proof, for a scheme that's a mix of implicit and explicit? So for something that's a theta that's between 1 and 0.
Right. So you think like in terms of the general case. Yes, that can be done as well. I believe I haven't gone through the proof myself, so I can't tell you exactly. But yeah, you can with a hybrid sort of implicit explicit version, it should work as well. So you can focus first on theta equals zero, and then you do the theta equals one case, and then you just take the linear combination of the two. Okay, anything else? Otherwise we should probably move on in the interest of time. We only have 10 minutes left. It took a little longer than I thought, but that's fine. Okay, maybe Boris and Guillaume can tell us about the previous problems. Maybe Guillaume first, so that we make sure that everyone gets a chance to present today.
Okay, okay.
if you're okay with that.
Sure. Is there a way I can share my whole screen? Oh, never mind. I think I got it. Can you see my
screen? Yeah, there should be an option way by which you can share the whole screen.
Can you see it now, actually?
Yes, we can see it.
Okay, so assignment three, problem two, was about solving the wave the heat equation numerically. So the first question, of course, is to design the numerical scheme. And we were given to use some finite difference approximations. So for time, it's first order in time. And for space, it's second order, both centered schemes. And so they give you a consistent scheme, consistent in the sense that the difference with the actual continuous value you would get for the derivatives is first order in time and second order in space. And explicitly, when you update the cell, so you have a time level n plus one, you get the value at that grid point rather than cell by adding this part to the previous value. Here, I don't know, I mean, I personally put it as a matrix equation because I found it useful to compare. Later, we use an implicit scheme and it's easier to think about them in terms of matrix equation. And when I wrote my Python code, I actually solved that matrix equation to update my spatial grid. That's not the simplest nor the most efficient way to solve this numerically, but it was just nice, I thought, in the context of this exercise. The main part of the question is to prove the convergence of this scheme. That is to show that the global error that accumulates between your numerical solution and the actual solution of the problem converges. So as you reduce your grid size and your time step, it goes to zero. And there's quite a bit of steps to go through to actually prove that. Maybe we should talk about C first. I think it makes more sense. We can actually show what conditions there are for a convergence analytically because we know about the Lax theorem. And so by performing Van Neumann analysis on the scheme, the numerical scheme we got in question A. I don't have it here. We can show that this coefficient G, which shows the growth in the norm of the solution, is actually bounded. So you plug some modes, the modes that encode the evolution of the numerical solution in time, you plug it into your scheme, and you find that the amount by which the solution grows in time is given by something that's bounded. So maybe you remember that the definition of stability is that it should be bounded by something one plus some parameter that's fixed that doesn't depend on initial condition. In fact, here we can show that that with alpha equals zero. So you get this solution, sine squared is bounded by one and lambda is always positive. So you can find this solution, condition, which is a condition on the time step, given a certain grid size. And what we found is that if you satisfy this inequality, then your scheme will be stable. And then you have to invoke the Lax theorem, because remember what we want is convergence, and we've just shown stability under certain condition. But the Lax theorem tells you that if you have stability and that your initial conditions are convergent, then you have a convergent scheme. You also need initial conditions that are consistent. So now going back, we know that the analytical solution is given by this sum of modes. And the problem is, of course, that we have a discrete grid, so we can't just plug that in and have a sum to infinity. And that's because the modes, right, oscillate with a certain frequency, and there's only your grid, your numerical grid, can only resolve up to a certain frequency, the Nyquist, frequency. So when you actually compute your numerical scheme, the best you can do as far as initial conditions are concerned are really this sum up to 1 over your grid size, which is your Nyquist frequency. Now, I mean, I guess you could ask whether that influences the solution you get later, but the good thing about the heat equation is that each of these modes satisfies the heat equation separately. So they don't function. Actually, that's a detail. Sorry, I think I sidetracked there. The important part here is that if you use this initial condition, you can show that as you increase your resolution, so you decrease your grid size, then it's going to be consistent with the analytical solution. And therefore, you can use the Lax theorem, going back, to tell you that since you have stability, since you have an initial condition that is consistent with your analytical initial condition, then as long as you have that satisfied, your scheme will converge. So the limiting factor really is your the condition on stability that we found by doing the Van Neumann analysis. And if you plot that on a time step and a grid size graph, you find that this gray region, so everything below this line, this is a log-log plot, is stable. So if you any combination of grid size and time step within that gray region is going to be stable. So now, part B of this question asks you to compute, to evolve your scheme, where the crosses are here, the black crosses are. And as you can see, this segment is in the unstable region. And we see it here. So we see that as we move from the blue to the green solution, here I'm keeping, so for these plots show the evolution of your solution with time, blue being earlier, green the latest. And you can see just by eye for the smallest grid size that things go haywire. You clearly have done something wrong. And if you, for the largest grid size, it's not so obvious, but if you plot the global error, then you can find that as you increase your grid size, the global error increases, which is not what you'd expect. And we can explain this phenomenon just by looking at the fact that these evolutions we've performed, these simulations we've performed are here. So it's those three points. And they mostly lie on the instability region. And as we've proven, as we've shown in part C, that means that the scheme will not be convergent. And this is what we observe here. Okay, and then we do the same thing for a convergent part of this phase space. And I think it's here. And here we see everything going fine. So visibly the solutions look nice. And when you plot the global error, it decreases as you reduce the grid size. And as a bonus, you can see that the, well, you can't really see it actually, but you'd expect, because here you're decreasing the time step. Yeah, you're decreasing the time step. And we know our scheme is consistent with the the actual continuous equation with order one with respect to time. So you would expect a straight line here on the log-log plot with the gradient one. You don't quite observe that here. And I think that's because you're lying right on the edge of the stability region. So it's not quite there, not quite stable, and therefore not quite convergent. The rest of the question is about the Crank-Nicholson scheme, which is an implicit scheme. And you're basically, if we go back to this, if we go back to this matrix equation, which we're solving at each time step to get the next values for the grid points, then it's just a matter of replacing B and A according to the to this scheme. I think I've gone on for quite long already. If you repeat the same test as for convergence, you'll find that it pretty much converges everywhere because you find that it's stable everywhere.
Nice, and you have this nice plot. Maybe you can just go back. So these blue crosses down there. So this is I think the series you computed with the implicit scheme, right? Where you were showing that. Up there, points in E. Yeah, the red ones, exactly. Sorry, yeah.
So yeah, the implicit scheme is stable and convergent, even in a region that's completely out of the stability region of the explicit scheme.
Exactly. Okay, very nice. Thanks a lot, Guillaume. Do we have any questions on this?
If implicit schemes are just so much better, why aren't they used more?
that's a great question. So the problem is computational cost. So if you have an implicit scheme, it always involves inversion of a matrix, for example. So Guillaume has shown this here on the solution, right? So you get this matrix A, I think you called it A on the left-hand side. And so you have to compute an inverse matrix essentially to evolve the scheme. And so it's really that computational extra cost that you don't want to do unless necessary. Explicit schemes are nice because you can write down an explicit formula for the update, and it's essentially a bunch of algebraic manipulations. While for the implicit schemes, there's a matrix inversion usually involved. Okay. Anything else? Okay, if not, thanks again, everyone. That was great. I like that session on all your practical results. Unfortunately, it took a little longer than I thought, but I think it was nice to have this discussion. So I was hoping to tell you more about extensions of our Godunov schemes to multi-D today as well, but we'll have to move this to Thursday, and I'll try to squeeze it into to this one lecture to tell you about how to extend that to multi-D, and then also how to get higher order accuracy for these Godunov type schemes. Okay, and tomorrow I'll be also there for office hours as usual. If people have questions, I want to ask other discuss other issues or have any other thoughts. Okay, then see you all on Thursday. Thank you.
I really enjoyed the presentations. Thank you for all the hard work there.
Yeah, thank you all. I also really enjoyed going through all the different solutions you guys came up with, and there was some creativity at work, and that I liked to see. So yeah, thanks.